Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is actually just me, because Corey is off doing important business things, and I still wanted to get a recap of day three out for RSA, because there were some really good talks today. With that, let's go ahead and just hop right in, and Corey's not here to give me crap for saying hop right in again for the millionth time. All right, let's go ahead and get started. So the first talk I went to, the title was Creepy Leaky Browsers, and it was a talk put on by Daniel Ayoub and Dean Weinart out of LexisNexis Risk Solutions. And this whole talk was basically about all the different ways that websites and web servers and anyone that can see your network traffic can fingerprint your browser connections. So every single browser has standards and APIs that they're supposed to support. They're put together by standards communities. But the truth is that each browser kind of supports them in slightly different ways. And those different ways that they respond to API requests, for example, can build a picture of whoever is connecting to this site. They're kind of used in a few different ways. There's the slightly concerning ways with digital marketing, for example, where even if you don't log into a website, as you go hop across the internet, each website you go to can associate your connection with, say, a previously used connection, like the last time you visited the site, or if they're owned by the same company or they share the same analytics built into the back end, they can track you across different sites and then provide advertisements to you that match your previous browsing history. They're used in user experience as well, so analytics to build sites to provide a consistent experience across platforms. They can be used as return device recognition is the bullet he used, but basically it's recognizing when a user returns to a website for a company that's providing some sort of product or service. So without you even logging in, they can say, oh, based off this fingerprint, we know you visited 2 weeks ago and you were working on this thing, so here's the ability to continue working on that thing. The way that LexisNexis was looking at it was actually for fraud prevention, though, where they would use browser fingerprints to track users for, say, e-commerce sites or banking websites. And then if suddenly someone tried to use user credentials, for example, and the fingerprint for the browser didn't match who they had a record for associated with those credentials, it would throw off red flags of potential fraud abuse. Maybe the account credentials got stolen. And you've probably seen this in use if you've ever gone and visited, say, your banking website or some other sort of sensitive account from like a library computer or a new laptop, or maybe if you just hop on from a different city, like if you're traveling, you might be prompted to enter in a one-time password from your phone or your email because you triggered some sort of different fingerprint. So now they're concerned that someone else is using your account. Interestingly enough, so they actually threw up their, they had like an impromptu raise your hands on a whether you're okay with people using your fingerprinting for advertising. And just about everyone in the audience raised their hand saying, no, we're not okay with them using that. Then they said, all right, well, what about fraud prevention? And just about everyone in the audience agreed that it's okay for fraud prevention. So it's definitely, it's a mixed bag here where it could be for good uses and it could be abused for privacy impacting uses. The way that these browsers generate fingerprints, there's a whole bunch of different fingerprintable attributes. So for example, cookie-based identifiers like your session cookie, first-party cookies, third-party cookies that browsers are slowly starting to get rid of. There could be hardware-based identifiers. So what CPU your computer's using, how much RAM it has, what GPU it's using, what driver that GPU is using, even your screen resolution or sensors built into it, like at a, for example, a mobile phone, readings off the ambient light sensor. Could be based off network information, so obviously the public IP address you're coming from, but you might not have known your browser actually has access to the private IP of the computer it's on too. So those two can pair together for a fingerprint. Your DNS configuration or DNS resolution, what ISP you're coming from, what connection type, and then just info from the browser itself and the operating system. So what type of browser, what version, what operating system you're on, what JavaScript version are you using, location information, what fonts you have installed. All of these little things can be pieced together kind of to build a pretty good picture of individuals within their own sessions. They kind of liken this to, can be used for good or bad, like in a similar way to when CDRs first came out. So for example, CDR, recordable media back in the day, it could technically be used for piracy, but it could also be used just for taking your digital photographs and sticking them on some sort of physical media for storage. If you want to actually get an idea of your browser fingerprint, they linked browserleaks.com and they showed all the information that it had access to. So your local IP address, it could do device enumeration, so it could see how many cameras or microphones you had installed, your screen resolution. They gave the point that, for example, Tor, the Onion router, the dark web browser you might know it as, actually recommends running it in a virtual machine or in windowed mode so that you don't give up your screen resolution as a fingerprint. A single call to an HTML5 API, for example, has 314 different potential features that your browser could or could not support. All those together could be a fingerprint. The time zone that your computer's in could be a fingerprint. And from a fraud prevention standpoint, this was actually really interesting, where they pointed out that maybe an attacker can spoof the IP address, or they could use a VPN to make it look like they're coming from like the United States, even though they're in some other country. But maybe they forgot to change the time zone on their local computer. And if the time zone doesn't match the geolocation that you're supposed to be coming from, that could be another red flag right there too. They mentioned sensor data, so ambient light, even the accelerometers and gyroscopes in your phone, these are physical measurement devices, physical pieces of hardware, and the calibration of them could be used as a fingerprint as well. This is actually something Apple patched in iOS 12 because people were starting to use that as a fingerprint method. They pointed out another interesting flag that they started checking where, for example, Safari, the browser, doesn't actually provide information on the CPU or memory while most other browsers do. So if a browser says it's coming from Safari, and the website's able to get info on the CPU and memory, they know that that individual is spoofing their browser to make it, or their user agent to make it look like it's Safari in that case. So they also showed off a few different tools that the bad guys can use that were pretty interesting. There was one, Anti-Detect 8 is what it was called, where it basically generates a unique browser fingerprint for each individual connection that it makes out. It can be used for example, a credential stuffing attack, where if a banking website or Gmail or something sees 1,000 connections from the same fingerprint trying a bunch of different credentials, that is a massive red flag for fraud detection. But if you can use this Anti-Detect 8 tool to spread it out across a bunch of different fingerprints and maybe use proxies to send it through different IPs, it could allow that attack to possibly succeed. Interestingly enough, this tool was stupid expensive. It was $3,000 with a $100 monthly payment for maintaining the service. It's insane how expensive it was. There were cheaper options too, though. There was one called FraudFox, which, I mean, they're not exactly trying to hide what they're trying to do with this application. That said, apparently they're going through a rebranding effort right now to call it FFox, where this one actually spins up a new instance of an entire virtual machine for each connection using OpenBox. That one's only $99 a month. There was another one, a tool called Sphere, which claims to be for developers who are trying to test like in QA environments. But you can actually buy and create different profiles and then load them into it. And it has modes like off the record mode or OTR it's called, where the entire thing can be run in a RAM disk, meaning that when you close it, there's no legacy information behind it about what websites you're visiting. Somewhat suspicious features in there for a developer tool. But long story short, the bulk of this talk was about the different ways that your browser can be fingerprinted. And so their takeaways were ways to try and get around that, or else keep you safe if you are privacy focused. And they've mentioned some technical tools you can use, like extensions like uBlock Origin, or Ghostery that can help block trackers from tracking you across sessions. I know personally, I use browsers like Brave that have that built into it too, which are pretty cool. But they also pointed out that unless you know exactly what you're doing, you're often better off just blending in with the crowd instead of trying to hide your tracks. Like if you start messing with your settings manually or trying to mess with like the user agent or messing with your fingerprint, that can set off red flags that might make people track you differently then. Whereas if you use just a default browser with the default settings, you're probably in a better place because you can hide in with the rest of the sheep is what they said. So overall, pretty interesting talk. I was sitting there the whole time as they were going through all the different ways that you can fingerprint a browser, and I'm just shaking my head going, oh, this is kind of terrifying. The next talk I went to, though, was called How Smart Cities Become Wise. It was by Gary Hayslip, who's the Director of Information Security at SoftBank Investment Advisors. And he, I guess, has a pretty big history when it comes to smart cities. He mentioned he was the CISO of San Diego for a few years and really led the way during their smart city initiative to try and make sure that it rolled out with a secure game plan. So his talk started out by saying smart cities have been around for a while, like the 1970s even. The city of LA was one of the first cities to use mainframes for some of their applications for, like he said, receiving money off of permit payments. But it wasn't really until 2009, 2010, where IBM put out this marketing initiative for smart city planning. And that caused a whole bunch of cities to go, oh, yeah, you know what, maybe we should do that. It even caused a few ISO standards to be created. If you're a nerd and you want to look them up, it was ISO 37150 and 37151 are the main ones. And then 37120, which is basically a checklist that a smart city can use to go and make sure they're meeting all of these potential security criterias. Now, when it comes to smart cities, what constitutes a smart city? It's basically a collection of sensors of some type paired with a network layer to move data around, and then paired with a service layer where you access that data and provide some sort of service. So he gave a few examples, like a city he worked with was using GPS tracking for just about everything that was city owned, from like manholes to fire hydrants to trees. And they could use the data from that to, for example, build a map of areas with not a lot of city owned trees. And if, for example, someone wanted to get a permit for solar panels, they could be auto approved or at least fast tracked in that sort of area. But one of the more demanding problems when it comes to implementing new smart city technology, he mentioned, is really managing what's currently in place while adding this new stuff. So some of the challenges he mentioned were network traffic and not even knowing where the perimeter is. So in a lot of these cities, they had already started adding things to the network, and it was difficult to figure out like where the perimeter was, where things were connected, what was using what had connections to what, in some cases just completely flat networks. Obviously, a big issue is legacy systems, things that are no longer maintained that might just be full of vulnerabilities. Really, a limited security budget or staffing or skills, something that's a big problem across just about all industries with the cyber skills gap. But with smart cities specifically, it's an issue because a lot of the infrastructure they're using is really old and might be using, for example, really old programming languages like COBOL to maintain it. That's a big issue in the financial industry, too, where you can't get new people that know how to work on it without massive amounts of training to get them up to speed. He mentioned that smart technology has its own problems. We've talked about IoT on this podcast about a million times. So you probably know most of the problems, but like vulnerabilities, open ports, undetected file changes or process behavior, poor authentication, and insecure network protocols are all major issues when it comes to smart technology, even in smart cities as well. And so he gave a few examples about where this can go wrong. Like in 2019, ransomware was a massive issue across cities, municipalities, everything. He pulled out some stats, like 966 government entities, universities, and healthcare providers were hit with ransomware in 2019. at an estimated cost of $7.5 billion due to lack of productivity and lost data, which is a huge amount of money from just these small sectors of cybersecurity. He gave a good analogy that if you're going to do security for a city, it's a lot like raising a child. It's not just you implement security and leave it. You really have to nurture it, keep maintaining it, make sure that it grows with your organization, or in this case, your city. And then he gave some tips about how to, quote unquote, become wise when it comes to smart cities. So the first one was understanding what's important to the organization. So like what data, what apps, what processes you use, your networks, basically building a map of all the things that you have and all the things that you will implement as you roll out a smart city. And then deploy a cybersecurity framework. He gave a good example of this where East Greenwich in Rhode Island, it's a really small city of only 10,000 people, but they really did security correctly when it came to their city. They actually got hit with ransomware last year, but it's one of the few cities that had a good story out of this. Their CIO had prepared a disaster recovery process, including backup and restoration processes that they had been testing. And so they got hit with this ransomware on Friday. They shut everything down over the weekend, and then they brought it all back up Monday without losing any data and without paying the ransom at all. And that's really something that all cities should have. I know Atlanta started an initiative to have a disaster recovery plan now, a bit late to the party, but hopefully it will help them in the future too. Next thing to becoming wise was implementing security controls that don't hinder users or hinder access. Because when it comes to security, you can make something totally secure by unplugging it entirely and turning it off. But you don't want to do that because oftentimes, you need access to this data, which means you need to provide security in a way that isn't overly restrictive to the people that need to use that data you're securing. A few more things like resiliency, make sure it's modular, make sure your security policies can grow with the rest of your organization. And then allow organizations to be innovative and deploy smart technology securely. So allow them, don't make it so stringent that if some new best practice comes along, they're not following some archaic thing just because that's the policy. He had a few other thoughts that I thought were really interesting. So he's really big on advocating for restrictions on ransom payments for municipalities because, like we've said a million times, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get your data back. It just further incentivizes criminal activities. So he wants legislation to explicitly block ransom payments from cities. And also he had an idea of if you're getting like federal aid, for example, you should have to follow some sort of security standard. And he mentioned that there's a lot of places, like in the state of California, for example, where they recommend standards that cities should follow, but none of them actually tend to follow it. And so instead of recommending it, requiring it if you're going to get any funding. So overall, another pretty good talk, and got a lot out of it in terms of securing smart cities. But man, the last talk I was so excited about, and it ended up being fantastic, was a talk called Shadow IT and Shadow Remote Access, How to Find It for Free. And it was by John Strand, who's the owner of Black Hills Information Security, a really big penetration testing company. He's also on the team that gets to pick talks for RSA. He's been doing security for quite some time, massively intelligent dude. And also, I will say, probably the best presenter I saw the whole weekend, just in terms of his delivery. But his talk was fascinating. So it's about Shadow IT, which is basically the applications or tools or backdoors that are on our systems that we might not necessarily know about. He mentioned that we're really good at finding security issues from like 5 to 10 years ago, and we're not so good at detecting a lot of these modern threats, Shadow IT being one of them. To give an example for this, he pulled up the MITRE attack matrix, which is like 300 or so, or like a couple hundred like areas that companies should make sure they're protected from when it comes to cyber attacks. And then he pointed out that a lot of organizations will just use like Nessus or some other vulnerability scanner as a way to check to see if they're vulnerable, just to see if they're vulnerable, period. And he pointed out that Nessus and other vulnerability scanners really only cover two of the things on the MITRE ATT&CK framework, exploiting of a public-facing application and external remote services. Like, for example, a vulnerability scan isn't going to tell you if your users are using weak passwords or if you have firewalls incorrectly configured. It's not going to tell you if you have Sysmon enabled with group policy on all of your workstations, for example. There's a lot that people will miss when they're just doing a bare bones check like that. He did mention that using a scanner as part of your security checkup is good, but you need to go much more in depth than that too. For example, like he mentioned that in every single hunt that his team has done, they found some sort of vendor software or appliance or something with remote access enabled. And the biggest offender of this was in hospitals, where they have a tool, like a network connected device or some sort of software that has basically a backdoor back to the vendor of that service, usually for diagnostic access. He gave another example, Nuance, which owns the Dragon speaking software that's pretty commonly used in hospitals and other areas. It actually has an option within that software to turn on remote access for Nuance to come in and troubleshoot software installation issues, for example. And luckily, that's off by default, but a lot of organizations will turn that on and then just completely forget about it. And now there's a backdoor to that system from the vendor. Another really big example, and probably the biggest one, are like us in IT. We tend to use applications like TeamViewer, for example. Like I've got it installed places so I can hop back into a system while I'm out. Or for example, like queue up a download of a video game on the bus ride home on my computer back at home. A lot of people will use this within organizations to bypass company, basically company policy controls. For example, you can use a lot of these tools from your web browser, like TeamViewer or Chrome Remote Desktop. And like, let's say if a site's blocked at work, well, you just use one of these to hop on your computer outside of work and you can go visit that site or whatever you're trying to do. It is a pretty massive vulnerability. For example, like TeamViewer even had a major vulnerability that was found a few years ago where I think it was 2016, where someone could have exploited that to access every single computer that had TeamViewer installed. So it's a massive vulnerability, and it's not one that something like Nessus would pick up. So he gave a few more examples about like penetration testing runs that his team went on, including one where they accidentally compromised an MSP. In this case, they were like testing a help portal for a company and was all completely in scope for their penetration test. They found that this portal, you could upload an attachment to help desk tickets that were created. So they uploaded a malicious attachment and then just waited. And within a few hours, they got a backdoor connection back to their command and control server. And it turns out that this company had outsourced their help desk to a service provider. And this backdoor was now on the service provider's network, which was entirely out of scope. They had to go contact their client and be like, oh, yep, you got to go talk to this MSP. We're not going to do it. And luckily, it was cooler heads prevailed and the MSP basically just got a free penetration test out of it. But that's a good example of oftentimes this interconnectivity between companies that we don't realize. Like the biggest example of this is Target, which got breached because of a service provider, in this case, an HVAC company that had network access to ultimately their payment card network. And that HVAC vendor was compromised through a portal, which the attackers then used to install malware and steal the payment cards from a bunch of huge amounts of Target customers quite a few years ago now. So after scaring the crap out of us throughout this talk, he showed off a few tools that he uses and some tools that his team maintains to try and detect some of these, for example, backdoor applications or even things like Metasploit or Meterpreter connections that are going out of your network. They basically revolved around this concept of long tail analysis. So first you look at all of the applications that are running on computers on your network, and you take the ones that are on like every single computer, the fat head is what it's called. So like Microsoft Office or Google Chrome or things like that. And you just kind of pull them out of the pile And then you instead look at all the ones that are only installed on a handful of systems. And these are the ones that could be potentially a backdoor or some sort of risky application that you might need to take care of. So he had a tool called Rita, which they had up on their GitHub account. You can find links to this, by the way, if you go to the RSA website and look up this talk. I would, if you're a technical person, take a look. It's actually pretty awesome. So this tool actually uses a few algorithms to take a look at network traffic and try and identify some of these applications that might be risky on computers on your network. I pointed out a few other ways. You can use like T-Shark, for example, to read a packet capture and sort data transfer by internal IP address to external IP address and data size. So if you're seeing a huge amount of egress data from an IP address inside going to something outside, that could be an example of someone exfiltrating data or maybe a backdoor. He talked about a lot of the challenges in detecting some of these backdoor connections. So for example, if an outbound connection from a client inside your network to some server outside the network has been up for like 24 hours, that lights up like a Christmas tree as, oh, this is probably some sort of backdoor connection going out. On the flip side also, if you have one that, say, resets itself every second or so, even that lights up like a Christmas tree. And tools like he mentioned, Cylance, are really good at catching backdoors like that that have just a second-long session. He mentioned a few really annoying ones where they'll kind of stagger their session timeouts anywhere like 30 minutes plus or minus a few minutes, which makes it really difficult to analyze them. The analogy he used was like if you take a bunch of spaghetti and just break it in half, you'll get a bunch of really tall, really long strands of spaghetti, a bunch of really short ones, a bunch of ones in the middle, and it's hard to build an analysis of those bunches of spaghetti then because they're all these different sizes. So their tool would put them all back together and reassemble them and then look at the sessions that way. So it was a really cool talk, really engaging talk about how to identify this traffic. I got a lot of ideas about it. And overall, that was easily my favorite talk of the entire week here at RSA, which now with that, this is our last recap of RSA. We're done. I'm heading home tomorrow or probably today by the time that this gets posted. And man, I'm ready to sleep in my own bed again, as much as I like San Francisco. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed the episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_, Corey is at @SecAdapt, and the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening. We will most likely not be back on Monday, but maybe sometime later in that week before we resume our usual schedule the week after. See you around.